one beautiful warm and sunny day recently, I was sitting on a bench, a park bench at Piper's Lagoon Park, one of our lovely local beach parks. It's quite close to where we live in Nanaimo here. I was sitting there, and as I often do, and that there, it's a nice place to go and pray. And I was just marveling at all the different kinds and the different sizes of rocks and stones, all the way from the huge, magnificent mountains of the coastal mountain range over on the mainland, all the way down to the tiny pebbles right there on the beach. Thousands of pebbles, probably, actually billions of pebbles if you think about it. And they sent me to thinking about all the stones and the rocks, both large and small, that are mentioned in the Bible. So let's talk about some of these today on this last day of Unleavened Bread. The rocks and stones of the Holy Bible, as relevant, I believe, to this season of the sacred God's sacred year. Now, God frequently uses the symbolism of rocks and stones in his word, and he even uses them as symbols of certain people. And I'm sure that when I say this, that my first example might come immediately to your mind as well as it did to mine. Now, we know that the central character of the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread season is Jesus. Of course, it's Jesus. But there's another character who makes frequent appearances in the gospel accounts of the latter days of the human Jesus and the first days of Jesus' post-resurrection life. And his name was Shimon Kephas, or Simon Petros, or we better know him as Simon Peter. And if you'll excuse the pun, Peter's history, as we know it, is a somewhat rocky one. Somewhat rocky one, with many ups and downs. When we read in the scriptures of Peter, we read of Peter's part in the preparation of Jesus' final Passover. We read of his dialogue with Jesus during the foot-washing service. We read of his fervent promises never to deny Jesus, quickly followed by his denial of Jesus. We read of his accompaniment of Jesus to the Garden of Gethsemane, but his failure to watch with Jesus during Jesus' agonizing final night. We read of his violence, Peter's violence against a man by the name of Malchus, at the time of Jesus' arrest. And later we learn of Peter's early arrival at Jesus' empty tomb and his conversations with the newly resurrected Jesus. All of these things. But I don't want to, you know, without taking our minds away from Jesus, who again is the most central person to this Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread season, let's begin this two-part sermon by briefly learning some more about Peter and his relevance to our subject. First, let's go back to the initial meeting between Peter and Jesus. Let's go, first of all, just one little verse, Mark chapter 3 and verse 16. Mark chapter 3 and verse 16. And Simon, he, Jesus, surnamed Peter. And the Greek is Petros. Peter comes from the Greek Petros. The Apostle John goes into more detail in his Gospel account. Let's go over to John chapter 1. John chapter 1. And verse 41, John chapter 1 and verse 41, he, talking about Andrew, Andrew first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah." We have found the Messiah. In the Greek that is Messias, and the Hebrew is Mashiach, which is translated the Christ. In the Greek is Christos. Verse 42, and he brought him to Jesus. Now when Jesus looked at him, looked at Peter or Simon, he said, "You are Simon, the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas." Cephas, K-E-P-H-A-S, which is translated a stone. The Greek is Petros. Please note that John's repetition of the phrase "which is translated," okay, which is translated, it gives some idea almost of a kind of comparison between the Christ and the stone when you compare these two verses. And there's certainly nothing wrong with the name Simon. It's a very good name. The New Testament Simon is the same as the Old Testament Simeon. Comes from the Hebrew Shimon, S-H-I-M-O-W-N, which stems from the root verb shama, which means to hear, to hearken, perceive, to discern and understand, also to obey, to publish, to declare, to tell, and to report. And finally, to be diligent, to be diligent. So Simon, it really is a fine name. There's a BBC, a Jewish BBC presenter, his name's Simon Sharma. He is Jewish, and it's like, he's like Shimon, it's almost like with him. Really interesting guy. Anyway, Jesus added a surname to Simon. He added a new name. And he added it actually in two languages, Aramaic and Greek. So Simon's new name, Cephas, is Aramaic in origin. And the Aramaic word Keph, K-E-P-H, means a stone. More specifically, a hollow stone, or the hollow of a stone. When it's translated into Greek, when the Apostle John wrote in verse 42, which is translated a stone, that translation, of course, was not into the English, but was into the Greek, Petros. And Petros means small stone, small stone. So please turn to Matthew chapter 16 now. And there we're going down in time, so to a later date, where Jesus discussed Simon's names once again. Matthew chapter 16, beginning at verse 13. Matthew 16:13. When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? So they said, well, some say John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And he said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And guess who was the first to pipe up? I'm sure you guessed right. Verse 16, Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." You are the Messiah, the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Verse 17, Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now we often tend to pick on poor Peter, and we pick on him because of his, we think, his foot and mouth disease and his other embarrassing mistakes, and maybe because some of them might remind us of our own shortcomings, I don't know. But here we read of Peter being directly blessed by Jesus after having been directly inspired by the Father. We continue in verse 18. And I also say to you that you are Peter, Petros, and the Greek for and here is Kai, which can also mean but. I also say to you that you are Peter, but on this rock, Petra, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Once again, please note another comparison that is implied here between Jesus and Simon Peter. We know that many or most professing Christian churches claim that Jesus was saying here that Peter was the rock and that Jesus would build his church on Peter. But this is not so. Absolutely not so. Let's examine the wording here. First, please notice the comparison once again. Jesus is saying to Peter, this is who you are, but this is who I am. Peter is the Petros, which means a small stone, what we would call a pebble, a little pebble. And God would not build his church on a Petros. God would not build his church on a mere pebble, but he certainly would build it on a Petra. And the Greek noun Petra means large rock, a cliff, a ledge, a projecting rock, or a rocky crag. Peter, once again, was a relatively small pebble, and Jesus was and is a huge rock. Jesus is referring to himself here. He is the Petra on which he would build his church. Now, the Holy Scriptures frequently mention rocks and stones in relation to buildings. For example, what did Jesus say that a wise man should build his house on? Let's go and look at it in Luke chapter 6, please. Luke chapter 6 and verse 47. Luke 6:47. Whosoever comes to me and hears my sayings and does them, I will show you to whom he is like. He is like a man which built a house and dug deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And again, the Greek word is Petra, on a rock, a Petra. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock, on a Petra. Jesus said this as a parable. Would Jesus not take his own advice? Of course he would. So what did the all-wise Jesus build his physical house and temple on? As detailed in 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Chronicles, which we looked at a couple of weeks ago, Jesus, the Lord Yahweh, had Solomon build his temple on a sturdy mountain, on the solid rock of Mount Zion, on the large symbolic stone ex-threshing floor that David had purchased from a man by the name of Araunah, also named in another place Ornan. There's so much symbolism in this, and the Apostle Paul alludes to that in a couple of places. We'll go to one right now and come back to some more later on. Romans chapter 9, please. Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9 and verse 33. Romans 9:33. As it is written, says Paul, and there was written in Isaiah chapter 8 and Isaiah chapter 28. As it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone, And the word stone there is from the Greek lithos, which is a large millstone. A large millstone. I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and rock. Word is Petra, a rock of offense. And whoever believes on him, on the Lord, Yahweh, Jesus, whoever believes on him will not be put to shame. So Mount Zion and the rock and the temple are all symbolic of Jesus. Let's imagine ourselves there in Jerusalem, 6 days before Jesus' last Passover, 6 days before his arrest, in Jerusalem, but not on the rock of Mount Zion in this case, but descending from the rock of the Mount of Olives. Luke chapter 19, please. Luke chapter 19. Beginning with verse 37. Luke 19, 37. Then, as he was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice for all the mighty works they had seen, saying, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." And some of the Pharisees called to him from the crowd, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." But he, Jesus, answered and said to them, "I tell you that if these should keep silent, the stones would immediately cry out." So these stones that Jesus was referring to, he was referring to the small stones on the roadside, small petroses on the roadside, which would be significant and symbolic of the humble human beings that the Father would raise up to worship himself and Jesus. Please turn over to Matthew chapter 3, because this reminds me of another relevant... Actually, if you can please bookmark Luke 19, if you would, we're going to come right back to it. But let's go to Matthew chapter 3, because what we just read there reminds me of another very relevant altercation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees as well, and this one with Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist. Now, John the Baptist, because he was an especially inspired prophet, as well as being of the priestly family, John the Baptist knew what was in the hearts of these evil people. He knew what they were doing. He knew what the priesthood was doing. And he knew what the Pharisees and Sadducees were doing. Matthew chapter 3 and verse 5. Then Jerusalem, all Judea and all the region around the Jordan went out to him, John the Baptist. He was a pretty famous guy, very, very popular, and were baptized by him in the Jordan, confessing their sins. But when he, John, saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to his baptism, he said to them, "Brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Therefore, bear fruits worthy of repentance. And don't think to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' For I say to you that God the Father, is able to raise up children to Abraham from these stones." And the stones that John the Baptist was referring to here were probably the pebbles of the River Jordan, the little petroses of the River Jordan, again symbolic of the humble human beings and even physical Gentile human beings that God the Father would raise up to become spiritual Israelites. But still, through the physical Abrahamic line, God did raise up his child, his son, his most significant child, the most significant stone, the cornerstone of his true temple's foundation, the rock and the Petra. And yes, God did also raise up another descendant of Abraham to become one of what we might think of as the first course of the foundation stone. Bricks and stones are laid down in courses, and if you think of it, the disciples, the apostles, were part of the first course of the foundation stones of the spiritual temple of the Church of God. And this one was Simon Petros, Shimon Kephas, the little stone. Jesus and the Father then continued their work through many other little stones, other children of Abraham, both physical and spiritual Israelites. Let's go back, please, to Luke 19, where we left off. Luke chapter 19, we left off there, and we were back in Jerusalem with Jesus. Luke chapter 19 and verse 41. Luke 19:41, and when he was come near, he beheld the city. Okay, not just the temple, but the whole city of Jerusalem, and wept over it. Go to verse 43, and this is Jesus speaking now. For the days shall come upon you, Jerusalem, that your enemies shall cast a trench about you. Could be an embankment about you, and compass you round, and keep you in on every side, and shall lay you even with the ground, and your children within you, and they shall not leave in you one stone upon another, because you knew not the time of your visitation. Of course, Jesus had warned the people of the church, and many of them had escaped or would escape in 70 AD or 69 AD over to Pella. But Jesus gave this dire warning here about the whole city of Jerusalem, not just the temple, although the temple certainly was included. And shortly after this, he gave another prophecy, a similar prophecy, specifically regarding the temple. Over in Mark chapter 13, please. Mark chapter 13. Mark chapter 13. And verses 1 and 2. Mark 13, verse 1. Then, as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Teacher," looking, you can imagine him in the evening looking back at the temple with the beautiful white marble and the gold trim glistening in the evening sun. "Teacher, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." And Jesus answered and said to him, "You see these great buildings? Not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Not one stone. Well, this temple was Herod's embellishment of the second temple, which was originally begun by Zerubbabel back in 535 BC, just after the Jews' return from their exile in Babylon. Herod began his reconstruction of the temple back in 19 BC, and it was still under construction during Jesus' human lifetime. Now we read here that Jesus foretold that it would all be thrown down totally, like Jericho, razed to the ground, the whole city and the whole temple. And it was. Please don't be fooled when you see videos of the Jews venerating their Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, because it is not part of the temple. Think about what happened there. Think about the Romans. To the Romans, the temple was the central symbol of all of their troubles from the Jews that they'd had from the Jews. So when the Romans flattened the whole city in 70 AD, there is absolutely no way that they would have left any of the temple intact. Some historical experts believe that even the summit of Mount Zion, on which the temple stood, was ground off, and the rubble was used to fill in the surrounding valley, so that Zion itself did not even exist as a mountain or even a hill anymore. So we think about the destruction of the temple of God in 70 AD, and Jesus saying that there would not be one stone left upon another, and the whole of Jerusalem as well. What about the spiritual stones of God's spiritual temple, of which today's scattered Church of God congregations are likely a mere remnant? Question: will God's spiritual temple be totally dismantled and thrown down like its physical counterpart was in 70 AD? Well, I believe that the Church will come dangerously close to that because of what Jesus said. You don't have to turn there. You're very familiar with Luke chapter 18 and verse 8, where Jesus said, "When the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth?" Which indicates, you know, the size of the Church, the body of believers at that time. But I don't believe that the Church of God will be totally torn apart because of what we read earlier. We've already read this in Matthew chapter 16. "On this rock, on this Petra, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." So despite all of the scattering that we've seen in God's church, especially since Herbert Armstrong's death, Jesus has promised that he will not permit anything to totally prevail against his true church. So no, it will not be totally dismantled. So what stones should impress us? Remember how awed the disciples were, we just read that, by the temple stones, and they certainly must have been extremely impressive. Just read you a little encyclopedia article about Herod's temple. It says, "As for the temple itself, it was made not of local stone, as was the rest of the complex, but imported white marble, which was in sharp contrast to the entire city and gleamed in the daylight. The gleaming white marble of the edifice was visible from well outside the walls of the city, and the scale of the building was designed to impress, and it dominated the landscape, effectively becoming the focal point of Jerusalem." Now, we human beings are prone to be very impressed by huge stones and rocks, whether they be vast islands or huge mountains, or, you know, rocks and stones that have been cut and built into magnificent buildings or have been shaped into beautiful artistic sculptures. And I freely admit to being totally awed the first time that I ever saw Stonehenge, 5,000 year old Stonehenge in England, when you drive up over this ridge and all of a sudden there it is in the distance. It is astonishing. and the huge passage tomb of Newgrange in Ireland. Absolutely amazing technology and engineering. And then going to the natural world, still in Ireland, there's a series of cliffs in Donegal called Slieve League, just breathtaking to look at them, the size of them, going right down into the Atlantic Ocean. And certainly not forgetting our own magnificent mountains right here in Western Canada, right here, the beauty of the mountains right here on the Vancouver Island Range, stunningly lovely. But Jesus, the rock, the Petra, was not too impressed with physical stones. Why should he be? He created them all. And sometimes when I'm praying at Piper's Lagoon Park there and gazing out at those stunningly beautiful mountains over on the mainland, and I praise God in my prayer for the beauty and magnificence of those mountains, I can just imagine our Father and Jesus saying to each other, and perhaps with the proper kind of pride in their handiwork, yeah, we made that. Just imagine that. As well as having created them, Jesus and his Father also have all power over them, over the mountains and the rocks. Jesus and his Father have the ability to do with them as they will. Just think, I mean, all different sizes of stones, all different kinds of stones. Remember the huge thing that the Lord Yahweh did with David's tiny sling stone. Remember Jesus' assurance of his and his Father's ability even to move mountains under the right circumstances. They can do that. If they created them, they'd certainly have no difficulty moving them. Remember what the Lord promises to do with rocks in the future. Something else that I've meditated on during my Piper's Lagoon prayers. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 4. Just one verse there. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 4. Very well known verse, and repeated in the New Testament as well, but sung about in Handel's Messiah. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 4, every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low. Imagine that. If you think about that, that the huge change that's going to take place, imagine all of those huge mountains becoming valleys, and all of the valleys and oceans becoming mountains at some point in the future. It reminds me of an old Nat King Cole song. The Rockies may crumble, Gibraltar may tumble, they're only made of clay. As referring to that prophecy, maybe, I don't know. Jesus and his Father, they made short work of the thick rock wall of the sepulchre that entombed Jesus' dead body. Once Jesus' Father had resurrected him and woke him from his sleep, Jesus walked right through the rock walls. Let's go to Matthew, please, once again. Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27 and verse 60. Matthew 27:60, and talking about Joseph of Arimathea, and Joseph laid Jesus' dead body in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. So the the tomb itself was had been carved out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed, verse 66. So they went and made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. So there you've got this huge stone over the door of the tomb. Then after 72 hours, going over to Matthew chapter 28 and verse 1, Matthew chapter 28 and verse 1, now after, or in the end of the Sabbath, as it should be, now in the end of the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat on it. In order to allow Jesus' friends and relatives as well to see inside the tomb, this angel broke the seal and rolled back its huge stone door as easily as if it had been made out of papier-mâché. But Jesus didn't need to wait for the angel to open the stone door of the tomb, because now, as a born from the dead spirit being, Jesus had the ability to walk right through its stone walls. And so we celebrate the resurrection. So we celebrate the resurrection. And my point here, though, is that Jesus and the Father are not impressed by physical rock and stone. And Jesus advises his brothers and sisters to emulate him in this and to be very limited in any awe that we might have of physical rock and stone, no matter how mighty or no matter how artistically shaped. Let's look at Acts chapter 1 verse. In Acts chapter 17 and verse 29, Acts chapter 17 and verse 29, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, and we are brothers and sisters of Jesus, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Yeah, there are beautiful sculptures, but do we worship them? No, we don't. Is God like gold or silver or stone? Of course not. God tells us which rock we must be impressed by. God tells us what our foundation stone must be. God tells us which foundation stone we must build upon. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. First Corinthians chapter 3 and beginning with verse 11. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear. For the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work, which he has built on it, endures, he will receive a reward. But if anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. I looked up to see what the melting point of diamonds is. And the melting point of diamonds is 6,416 degrees Fahrenheit. And if you think about it, that's how the Lord Yahweh formed diamonds in the first place. by using super high temperatures and super high pressures deep within the Earth's mantle. But even the very hardest stones, including diamonds, will melt once the temperature gets high enough, which one day it will. Let's go over again to 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. We read this a couple of weeks ago. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10. We'll read verses 10 to 13. 2 Peter chapter 3 verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements, including all of the diamonds, shall melt with fervent heat. You can imagine over 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved into a liquid, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conversation or conduct and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat? You think about what's going to happen then, you just wonder, is this perhaps how God will, when he melts all of those beautiful diamonds and other precious stones, is that how he will rework those precious stones into the huge magnificent gates and foundation stones of the new Jerusalem? Now let's go over to Revelation and just read that. Revelation chapter 21. It's just hard to get your mind around the size of those walls and the foundations. And each one of them, each one of these foundations is going to be a single precious stone. But not the little tiny ones that we see today. I don't see them very often, but you see them, you know, I mean, the biggest diamonds are like the ones in the British Crown Jewels. They look pretty big, but can you imagine what these are going to be like? Revelation chapter 21 and verse 19. Revelation 21 verse 19. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. And it sounds as though they're going to be studded with them, but when you read on, it sounds like each one is going to be an individual stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third a chalcedony, the fourth an emerald, the fifth the fifth sardonyx, the sixth sardius, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth a topaz, you know, an individual topaz, the tenth a chrysoprasus, the 11th a jacinth, the 12th an amethyst. Just astonishing what that's going to be like. Hard to get our minds around. Okay. But again, God warns us of the grave danger of the wrong use, and he warns us of placing too much importance and too much valuation of such stones, whether precious or semi-precious or otherwise, because this can cause them to become objects of worship, idols. Still in Revelation, let's go back to chapter 9. Revelation chapter 9. Talking about the plagues of the last days. Revelation chapter 9 and verse 20. Revelation 9:20. But the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see, nor hear, nor walk. And through the Apostle John here, in chapter 17, let's go over to 17, just pick out one verse here. Through the Apostle John, Jesus has given us a stern warning against the idolatrous worship of the harlot, the great harlot, the bejeweled harlot. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 4. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. So, you know, in the end times, the people of the world are going to be impressed by this woman. They're going to be impressed by her precious stones and her pearls and her gold. And just even today in this regard, you know, if you've ever been into a cathedral or you've seen them on TV or a mosque on TV, and you see these huge over ornamented stone temples and cathedrals and mosques of the world's false religions and other huge buildings as well that are symbolic of the world's idolatrous worship of all things physical. And just think back at the doomed twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, what it symbolized. Why would anyone worship Babylon the Great and all their precious stones? Especially us, because we know that she is soon to suffer a doubly hard fall. Both her and the value of her stones. Still in Revelation chapter 18 now. Revelation chapter 18 and verse 2. Revelation chapter 18 and verse 2. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Verse 11. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, because for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Verse 12. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron and marble, all from different kinds of stone. But it's interesting that when her end comes, that it will be another stone, a mighty stone, that will put an end to her. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, and threw it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence the great city Babylon shall be thrown down, and shall not be found any more. Now this event is also described in similar terms as well by the prophet Daniel in his interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's image dream. And Warren went through that a couple of months ago as part of his Daniel series of Bible studies. And we're going to briefly review those verses for our purposes. Not today, though. We're out of time for today. So we'll leave it there today, brethren, and we'll take another look at Nebuchadnezzar's image dream this coming Sabbath when we get to part 2.